All right, folks, I am here with Luke Yost and Patrick Clark, the gentleman behind Molotov Angel Productions, and the team responsible for the History of Sierra Online documentary that you've probably heard something about. How are you guys doing today?
Doing great.
Doing very well, thank you.
Okay, so why don't we just get started with what is this project you guys are working on?
Well, the name of the project is called Heroes, A History of Sierra Online, and it's a feature-length documentary film about the life and times of a company that a lot of people, I know yourself and many people in your audience, are near and dear with, a company that brought us a lot of different adventure games, Leisure Suit Larry, Phantasmagoria, King's Quest, Space Quest, and so many others. So we've, Patrick and I, about a year and a half ago, formed Molotov Angel Productions, and as our inaugural project, decided that we wanted to focus on History of Sierra Online. And from there, just took it from there, and now we're producing a film about the people and stories behind the company.
Well, before we get into the film, I just wonder what draws you to Sierra so strongly, to the point where you'd want to dedicate all this time and money and resources to making a documentary about it?
It's something I've always wanted to do. Like, I grew up with those games ever since I was a little kid. My dad would take me, he used to work at Aetna, and my dad would take me in, and I'd play Leisure Suit Larry. And
how old were you?
I was really young.
You're Patrick, right, that I'm talking to?
Yes. Yep.
so Patrick, how old were you when you were playing Leisure Suit Larry?
A little too young to recognize all the sexual innuendos. But I still loved it all the same. I loved the adventure, point and click. Well, it wasn't point and click at that point. But And then for a birthday, I got Quest for Glory, the remade VGA version, and I just became completely obsessed with Sierra games. And that's years and years go by, and I had never like forgotten about it, and I've always wanted to do a film about these people. And now we had the opportunity to meet with them and talk with them and make a movie about it.
What about you, Luke?
I wasn't as much of a diehard fan as Patrick was with the Sierra games. They were certainly part of my life, but I played all sorts of different things growing up. So I think when we were coming together around, you know, coalescing around an idea, Patrick brought this up. And while I was familiar with the company, I didn't have that hardcore drive that he necessarily did. So I just immersed myself in research and sort of went behind the scenes about the different people that were there and, of course, the games and all of that. And what drew me was just the people behind the scenes were just had this fascinating story to tell. And it was just this motley crew of people, especially in the beginning, that came together to form this company. And then, you know, they had a couple of near-death experiences, skyrocketing success, and then dominated the industry for most of their life, and then eventually became this billion-dollar company. So the more research and the more I educated myself about it, I was like, this is incredible, and what a fantastic idea. So Patrick, you know, had the love of these games and the passion for them, and he introduced me, you know, a lot to them a lot after the fact. But what I brought to the table was just this sort of vapid interest, you know, in this story.
Well, Luke, Patrick, how did you guys meet each other? Have you been friends for a long time, or is this a, you know, professional thing or what?
Yeah, we've known each other since high school. It's been probably about close to 20 years at this point. I was actually very good friends with Pat's brother, who's also sort of a behind-the-scenes person in Molotov Angel. And Patrick and I have just gotten to know each other over the years. So we've worked together, and we've just known each other for a long time. And we shared a love of film and comedy and irony and satire and so many other things. And we actually both had television shows on our local public access station when we were in high school. I hosted one and he produced another, and for a time we actually on Friday nights were back to back on that channel's lineup, which was kind of cool.
Oh,
so
that's really cool, man. What kind of show was it?
Oh boy, well, mine was I belong to an Explorer post, which is part of the Boy Scouts, and so we produced a weekly show called Scouting Today, and I was associate producer and host of it, so I was responsible for putting the content together. So some of it had to be geared towards topics of interest towards Boy Scouts, but my interest was actually just interviewing people and getting stories out. So I would have local professionals come on. I loved getting the people from the local, like, NBC affiliate to come on, and just people that, you know, local newspaper, and just find out their stories and their careers and how they got to be where they were. So that was my passion, and Pat can take you into his show, which is
my show was a sketch comedy show. It's like completely stream of consciousness. It was really bizarre, and I look back on some of those skits that I filmed, and I wonder what I was thinking at the time. But yeah, and it was a lot of fun.
Not to cut you off there, Patrick. But
what's that?
I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you have more you wanted to add? Right. I was just wondering what kind of technical training you guys might have.
Oh,
have you taken
no.
some classes on filmmaking or studied books or? How did you learn the skill?
Well, I took film in college and I've been working with computer animation, video editing, even like stuff with Maya and 3D Studio Max, like things of that sort. So it's, you know, it's been a long road with that kind of stuff as far as Luke goes.
Yeah, as a career path, I chose to go the marketing route, and I've been working in event management for a number of years now. So what I brought to the table was just business sense, organizational tools, how to get things started, a good sense of just get up and go and getting in front of people and how to talk to people and just research and just all those million little things that aren't the sexiest and of elements to have to deal with, but just getting those together. And I think that some of the best training I had was that public access show, in terms of just having to interview people and get in front of them and understand how to pull a story out and put a story together. So I've always loved writing and just read a lot. So, you know, it's just all those things. And yeah, I've read some, you know, of course read some books on filmmaking and been involved in things here and there. So it's, you know, just all those things in life that lead up to a certain moment.
Well, how long have you guys been working on this Sierra documentary?
We started organizing it probably February of 2012, February, March 2012. We started that's when we started getting in touch with people, doing our research. Started principal filming in late June, early July of 2012, and just worked through the summer. Went out to Seattle, Oregon, spent some time in Oakhurst, and then the San Francisco Bay Area, and then did more some additional filming here on the East Coast for some of the Sierra alums that are still here between New York and the Mid-Atlantic region. And then, of course, interviewed Ken Williams and Roberta Williams last fall. So principal filming basically went from June through October of last year. We still have some more that we want to do this upcoming fall to finish everything up.
So do you have any good stories with sort of off-camera moments with these guys?
Oh, I think we've got quite a few. That's definitely a question we've gotten from some past interviews we've done. I will say this, yes. I mean, these folks were in an all-too-human situation, and they were just acting as a lot of creatives and a lot of technical oriented people would. So there, it was just like any other, you know, large dysfunctional family. They had their moments, but with each other and moments with, you know, gripes with management and, you know, just the way work process flowed and how resources were distributed. And, you know, they were a lot of these folks were very open and candid about that, but I think, like any of the dysfunctional family, at the end of the day, they had a great deal of respect for each other. And what they did was, you know, they helped found an industry and found a genre and, you know, brought joy and entertainment to just millions of people around the world. So, yeah, there were not to be overly coy about your question, but yeah, there was definitely some off-camera moments that were meant to stay off-camera. That's why the stories were shared there off the record. So but people were very forthcoming and honest, and this certainly isn't a G-rated documentary. I think there was a lot of very human moments shared in this, and a lot of comments and opinions shared that, you know, really helped to break down how the company worked and how people felt about each other and how they worked with each other. So it's a very well-rounded story.
So did you actually go to these people's homes and do the interviews, or were you at an office, a studio, a hotel? Where did you do your interviews?
Mostly at the homes of the people. They were very, very welcoming. They, like with the Coles and with the Idens and
Williamses,
Al Lowe, they all invited us into their homes to do the interviews.
They were extreme. I mean, every person was very giving of their time, and considering how many people we were trying to get together and, you know, spread out over a limited period of time, everyone was extremely cooperative. So it, in a lot of ways, the stars, the sun, and the moon all aligned for us. But yeah, we in Seattle, we did a bunch of interviews in a hotel, just did a lot one after the other for a couple of days, and went to people's homes, and yeah, just many, you know, various places. But yeah, vast majority of the interviews were in these folks' homes.
So were you looking around at their home and stuff in the shelves and whatnot, and thinking, wow, yeah, I can see that these are the folks that came, you know, they came up with Leisure Suit Larry or Quest for Glory. I mean, did you get the sense that you know, it was a GAN developer's home?
It's a mixed bag. I think the most memorable home was definitely the Coles, and they've lived in that home for many years. And I think during their time at Sierra as well. Mm-hmm. It's called the Flying Aardvark Ranch, and it's outside of Oakhurst. And
Did you see the aardvarks, first of all?
No, you know, that was the most disappointing part. We didn't. I guess it was just more of an ironic name.
Maybe they
than
were up
too
high.
Yeah, they definitely were, but their homes definitely were a reflection of their personality. These are two, in every loving way, very quirky people, very creative, and just so, so very intelligent and very well read. And so their home was definitely a reflection of that. And Lori Cole, you know, put out a display for us of artifacts, mementos from their time doing the Quest series. And
some of the stuff was like the clay molds that they used for the various characters in the very first Quest for Glory game, which was like really neat to see in person.
I mean, they actually had clay molds for all that.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Jim Walls invited us to his home, and God bless him, his mother.
Did he give you a pat down on the way in?
Oh boy. You know, we get to his driveway, and out
we
walks
should say,
his,
you know, this is the Police Quest guy, you know, for those who don't
know. Yes, the creator of Police Quest. And he walks out, and here's this guy who looks like he should be still playing like linebacker on a professional football team. And the man's in his 70s, and he's just jacked, and he's just sharp as a tack, and it couldn't have been more accommodating. His mother is 90 years old, lives with him. She had made us breakfast that morning. Wow. It's just, you know, a lot of this was just almost, it was just too surreal for us. And these people are just very welcoming and gracious and giving of their time. And the Idens as well, Marie and Chris Iden, were just fantastic. So, yeah, it was very interesting going into folks' homes and being in the Williamses. They spend most of the year on their boat sailing around the world. But when
you always see that picture of Ken and Roberta in like a yacht. I guess they have their own yacht.
They have
a fleet of these things.
They're just everywhere across the world at any given time. But it was great in their apartment. They had just a wall of sort of Sierra history, of old photos of them and some of the other folks and mementos, and that was really neat to look at.
And they had their own personal movie theater.
Yeah. Oh, they had their own theater?
Yeah. No other way.
They're probably the richest of all the folks, right?
They sold the company basically in 1996, and they did very well for themselves. which, you know, stands to reason. I mean, they worked very hard. They started this company out of their kitchen table when they were still living in the LA area, even before they moved up to the Oakhurst area. And it just started with an idea and a lot of hard work and a lot of sweat equity. And, you know, for about 20 years later, they were able to sell their company and make good for themselves as well as it should be.
You get the sense, you know, from going from their house to the other developers' houses, like, you know, they got the yacht, and Aulo over here has the dinghy.
Your question's well received. In the case of Aulo, Al has done extremely well for himself, so he's living pretty well.
He lives in a mansion.
Yeah, he's doing well for himself.
So it's not like the Williams were taking advantage of these guys.
No, I mean, I will say this, that, you know, a lot of these folks were, you know, they received, what I want to say, you know, incentives and commissions towards their games as well as other compensation that we're not completely aware of. But, you know, at the end of the day, these were probably upper middle class folks. And when Sierra went away, their livelihood largely went away. And so some of them were able to stay in the industry for a while. Others had to move on. I'd say most of them all had to move on. So I would say overall, everyone's doing well for themselves. Of course, yeah, the Williamses are on one end of the spectrum, and there are others that are, you know, have to have a 9-to-5 job nowadays and are still involved with the industry in one way or the other. But, you know, they're definitely, you know, have to work for a living.
So what made you want to take the documentary to Kickstarter?
Well, Kickstarter, we found, was a fantastic resource twofold. I mean, one is you get to raise funding towards completing your film and trying to get things done with, you know, if you can receive that funding, doing things with it that you might not be able to do otherwise in terms of technical services or getting rights to certain things. And then the other is it's one of the greatest, you know, viral marketing tools out there right now. And coming from a marketing background, I recognized that and said, this is a way to reach people, you know, very quickly and spread the word. And, you know, having, when we originally launched a year ago, having seen the guys from Andromeda, their campaign, Al Lowe's campaign was just finishing up successfully. So was Jane Jensen, Holmes' Kohl's project. Yeah, Kohl's, you know, recently had theirs. Yeah. And so it was just the Sierra community was alive and well, and we knew that was a great way to reach them and get the message going. We were, you know, unsuccessful in the first campaign, and rightfully so. People didn't know who we were. They met that with some suspicion, and that was perfectly understandable. So we, you know, went out saying, all right, we're going to go get some footage, cut a trailer, and come back, you know, in a year's time when we've got something to show and go from there. And, you know, the second one wasn't successful either, but what has been very successful about it is how we were able to spread the word and the amount of coverage and attention that this has garnered. And knowing now that we still have that platform, we still have those contacts, and we can get the word out there when the film is complete that this is how you can access it, this is how you can see it. And we're going to bring it to film festivals and as many places as possible. It'll eventually be available for digital download. So, you know, we want to reach the largest audience possible.
So are you planning to do another Kickstarter, or is this the last one, or what?
I can't say this 100% certain, but I don't know if there's anyone that's ever come back to Kickstarter for a third time. So since second time wasn't a charm for us, I don't think we can go back to the well once again. So
I just noticed something. I'm on the Heroes, you know, your Heroes, the History of Sierra Online Kickstarter page.
Yeah.
And you have exactly 666 Facebook shares. I don't know what that's a sign of. Well, you know what they say, third time's a charm, right?
It is.
Have you learned things from these previous two attempts that you would, you know, do things differently a third time?
Your questions are very and yes, and you know we've. After the first one, there were a million lessons learned. After this last one, I would say there were probably another million lessons learned. I mean, it's social media. I don't – whenever anybody says they're a social media expert, I don't believe them because it's such a fast-moving technology, and it's such a fast-paced society, global society that we live in now, that people want and expect, and rightfully so, instant feedback. And at the same time, they're sharing their feedback. So you get to learn right away what people want, what they're saying, how they expect you to act and react, and all of that. And, you know, there's no Bible towards this. There's no instruction manual on how to handle this. So especially the first time out, that was a large learning experience for us. And yes, I mean,
was it a painful learning experience?
Oh God. Well, I mean, you know, it's only human. I mean, you know, there's people that are very vocal, and, you know, there's always a handful of them that I think
are you just talking about trolls, or do you think that they had legitimate criticism?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I don't want to use that term per se. I think they're just very enthusiastic folks.
They're enthusiastic people who are passionate about the subject matter. And I wouldn't want to like delegate them to just trolls. But
I think what there's always a minority out there that expects a lot of different things from you, and the best lesson you learn is you can't be all things to all people, and you can't necessarily react to every criticism out there or every request out there, because some just aren't feasible. But what is good about this interaction is folks say, why don't you do this, why don't you do that, why can't we see this? And you're like, wow, that's really good solid feedback. So that's what you try to do through your updates. So that's why you try to put, you know, additional footage out there, or try to react quickly through either Facebook or Twitter or what have you. So I think everyone out there is very passionate about Sierra, and that's what we learned, especially the first time, and it presented itself the second time around again. I think you just have to, though, believe in what you're doing and believe what you're doing is right, because you can't be all things to all people, and some things just aren't possible for you to get done between time and resources available. So it overwhelmingly
kind of generalize a little bit about the sort of the expectations they had that just weren't feasible.
I would, you know, I think one of the first things that came out where people wanted, you know, you put incentives out there for your Kickstarter campaign at, right, you know, different monetary levels. So that was one of the first, you know, solid feedbacks that we got from a couple people. And we were like, okay, great. You know, this is what we do, you know? And so we reacted to that, and we put some additional levels out there. Quite honestly, you put them out there, and then they start criticizing that. And I think what may get lost on people is that this is a fundraising platform. Are things on there listed at a higher amount than you would find in the real world, whether it be
Walmart, oh my God, Target? It's $30 for a disc. You know, that sort of...
Exactly. And yeah, we're just like,
they just don't get the Kickstarter model.
I think to a certain extent, yes. And I think at the same time too, unlike, you know, another Leisure Suit Larry game, or the game the Coles were doing, or the guys from Andromeda, this isn't something that people are going to be playing. This isn't a tactile experience that we're presenting to them. So that was sort of difficult to go into that, saying we're presenting a film for you. We're going to present something that you can watch, something that you can't play. So I think that was, you know, that was part of the challenge in trying to react, that there's only so many things you can do, you know, and there's only so many incentives you can offer. So that you know, that's just part of the challenge of coming up with it. And we recognize that going in. We came in, you know, wide-eyed into this one, saying, obviously, we need to be aggressive about this. You need to raise enough funding, not only to, you know, try to get done what you want to with the film, but at the same time, you have to afford all of these incentives you're offering there, and you've got to be ready for that. And that's one thing you always try to explain to people, and I think some get it, some don't. And but, you know, you roll with the punches and you go on. But what's nice is that people are passionate about this subject. They're incentivized, you know, they want to see this happen. Most everyone wants to see this happen. And you know, every morning you wake up and you realize that people from Sierra, the alums, gave so generously of their time. There's a lot of folks out there giving you wonderful feedback and emailing us.
Ken Williams donated $1,000.
Yeah, sent us some great messages along the way. So every morning you wake up and you're like, that's your motivation to, you know, get this done. Because, you know, there's people out there with high expectations, and you want to meet those.
I'm looking at the comments here. I don't know if you guys have seen these.
Unfortunately, yeah.
want to steer clear of it, you know. But I mean, a lot of people are saying you guys just didn't communicate enough, you know, during the Kickstarter project. Is that true, you think, or
what's going on? You know,
I'm seeing you got like 14 updates, 13 updates. So I'm not quite sure where these guys are coming from. But you know, then again, I haven't really been on top of this, project. So what can you tell me about?
It's a very fair question, and I'm glad to address this now. It was a 30 to 35 day campaign. The expectation was that we were going to not only, you know, just put text feedback out there, but we were going to upload videos of just, you know, outtake moments or just stories that probably wouldn't make the film themselves, just to make this as, you know, 360 of an experience as possible to show people what to expect. So, you know, over that period, we posted a number of comments, did it through Twitter, did it through Facebook. At a certain point, I think certain people just want you to react or comment or reply back to every single comment that's there. And that's just not possible with the time of the day between what you're trying to do in your life, get things done with the film and manage the Kickstarter from there. And I know, you know, on the opposite end of the argument, somebody would say, you've got to be completely engaged and you've got to be updating all the time. And to be honest with you, there's been plenty of successful Kickstarter campaigns out there with maybe two comments. It really depends on a number of factors. And that's what I think makes Kickstarter unique, is each project is its own unique animal. It's its own beast. And you've got to just know how to handle it properly. So coulda, woulda, shoulda, hindsight being 2020, there's always certain things you could have done better. But when it comes to the communication, I honestly have no regrets. And I don't think Patrick does either. We uploaded videos.
My favorite comment here. This guy's got like a cat for an avatar, and Rigo. Wow, you can't even get someone to surface here when you insult them, like 4 exclamation points. Really considering pulling my dollar now. Wow, you donated, you know, you contributed $1. You know, we gotta make sure we give you the red carpet treatment here.
Yeah, it's, you know, it is difficult, but I mean,
that you have
I
to
will
deal
say
with
this them? In terms of negative comments.
I mean, just that sort of mentality of, you know, I gave you guys $1, and so now you're my slaves.
Right, exactly. $1 gets them a voice.
I will say this. It is difficult that the price of entry just has to be $1, and then you can just comment as much as you want, because I think that tends to skew what's going on, because at the end of the day, it's really just a handful of people that feel a certain way about things, while there's, let's say, 600 some odd backers or whatever the final number was. Quite honestly, there were maybe 10 to 12 people that were that vocal about it and that negative about it. So that simple math just says 90% plus people were very satisfied and happy with what was going on. And some people donated a large amount and didn't even want the incentive gift that came along with it. So you take the good with the bad. And I understand there's always going to be negative feedback wherever you go and whatever you do in life. But that's just why you have to use your own judgment and how you reply back to people. And what we would do is, especially throughout the process, there would be, let's say, a number of people all saying the same thing. Well, that's what we would try to do in an overarching update or an overarching comment. You just can't reply back to the same thing every time, because we know certain people were just then asking the same question later on and not even looking at the update. So, you know, it's there's only so much you can do.
I notice you've got 3 $10,000 level backers.
Yes.
Were those just random people or people that you knew?
No, to be honest with you, I don't know who any of those people were that donated it, who donated that amount. And those all came in, quite frankly, at the very end of the Kickstarter campaign. So I imagine those might have just been some people having some fun with the Kickstarter, knowing that there would be no.
Those are people that like to gamble, you know. That's what, what if there had been like a last minute, you know, surge of pledges, and they ended up blowing. Well, what happens to people if they don't actually pay?
The way Kickstarter works is you because I've donated to a number of of projects myself over the last year. You set up an Amazon account and you put a credit card towards it, so that when you sign in, you know, you have a unique profile on Kickstarter, and then you can donate whatever amount you want to various projects. And then when they're successful, they just charge your card. And if it's unsuccessful, you know, there's no charge.
Well, guys, it's been fun. For people that want to follow this project and, you know, eventually get to watch this documentary and actually own the Blu-ray or DVD or whatever it's going to be offered on, how can they stay in touch with you?
Absolutely. You can always follow us at MolotovAngel.com. We're on Twitter at Molotov Angel, and then we're on Facebook at Molotov Angel Productions. And then we posted some videos on YouTube as well. So we're everywhere, and we're going to continue to update folks as progress is made and the film nears completion, and there'll always be updates out there.
So can you give me sort of a rough time? What's the word I'm looking for? Like an estimated date of completion?
Absolutely. We want to be done by January 1st for 2014, and we're going to start getting it out to the film festival circuit then. And then somewhere down the road after that, we will have it ready for digital download.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, guys. I'll be sure to post the links that you mentioned in the show notes. Is there anything else that you wanted to add that we haven't covered?
We just want people to know that this is really going to be a fun, compelling story. And our mission with this is to create a film that can not only be appreciated by a diehard CR fan, but also someone who may just have heard of the company or someone who may not have heard of the company.
Someone who's just maybe like vaguely interested in video games, like they can find this movie interesting.
It's a very human story, and it's a very fascinating story to understand how this company came to life, what was going on behind the scenes, how these games were made. And the fact of the matter is the people who made these games, most of them came from the most unlikely of circumstances. I mean, in juxtaposition to where we are in today's video game and computer game world, these are people of our generation that have grown up playing these games, and they've, you know, gone to school in some instances to get these technical skills. In Sierra's day, they and Broderbund and Electronic Arts and LucasArts, for that matter, these were just people that had some sort of passion for games and computers that found their way to these companies and to this industry. And especially in the case of Sierra, this was just a company purposely located in a small town in Northern California. And they had folks coming in right out of high school. They had folks coming in who were school teachers and from any type of background you can imagine. And suddenly they became game designers and created some of the most popular and best-selling games of all time. It's just a really cool story, and it really helps to bring the games to life.
Yeah, something I think about whenever I think about it. I mean, people now, I guess a young gamer now, would look at a game like King's Quest or Police Quest and think, wow, mm-hmm. that looks so primitive, without even realizing that those were cutting-edge games back in the day.
Yeah.
Mystery House, King's Quest. I mean, this was like the cutting edge. They were actually defining the cutting edge.
It's an excellent point. And one point we want to get across in the film is just that these folks blazed the trail. All of the games you see now, especially Skyrim, I love to go to that example. That is very much had its root.
Skyrim.
If you want to go to like a King's Quest, that is, you know, if you want to look at a direct descendant of a game, that's the evolution of King's Quest, if you really stop and think about it.
Devolution.
From a technology standpoint. But it's just, these folks were at ground zero, and they really invented the process, and they refined the process. And so much of what is done today is just copycatting what they did. And these were the godfathers of the industry.
That's it. Skyrim was a bad game.
All right, folks, there you have it. Thank you, Luke and Patrick, and I hope to see you guys around in the near future.
Thank you, Matt.
Good luck on the film circuit, or what do we call it, a film?
Film festival circuit,
Good luck at
thank
the
you.
Film festival.
All right, take care. Thank you.